The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hello there, all. The weeks go by fast. Once again, Dennis and Julie, Dennis Prager and Julie Hartman.
Hello, everybody.
Have a good week. Bye, everybody.
Shalom.
You know what shalom actually means?
Peace.
Yes, that's right. It's a very interesting word because it's related to the Hebrew word shalem, which means complete.
So I was recently rereading the book that you recommended to me, Mario Pi's The Story of Language, which, by the way, I've had listeners of Dennis and Julie email me at julie@julie-hartman.com, by the way. Now I don't have to say it at the end, Sean. And they have ordered that book, even though it's out of print, but you can find it on Amazon. But he had a section on Semitic languages, right?
Yes,
Arabic,
right.
And Hebrew. And I didn't realize that the vowels are accents.
The vowels are dots and dashes.
So there are,
yes,
only consonants in
That's
Hebrew
right.
letters? Wow.
And by the way, overwhelmingly in Arabic as well. That's correct.
Arabic is really beautiful to look at.
The script?
At.
Oh,
gorgeous.
That's fascinating. Well, you know, it's almost a design.
Yes.
Because it, in medieval mosques, for example, you don't have to. I read Arabic, but.
You read Arabic?
You didn't know that? Oh, I'm glad you didn't know that.
That's
so
incredible.
Sweet.
Wait, really?
Yes,
you
really.
Can read Arabic?
Yeah.
Wow.
I took Arabic for 3 years. I was at the Middle East Institute.
I can't. The feeling I feel right now of being so unaccomplished is very overwhelming. I can't speak or write or read anything besides English.
What about music?
Interesting.
By the way, people should know, if you give your kid a musical instrument, you are so expanding their mind.
Yeah.
Because it is another language.
Yep.
It literally, it's another alphabet. It's completely another language. And it's to me, the greatest language, obviously.
Well, back to the Arabic thing, just quickly, you'll find this to be interesting. I recently had Spencer Klavan on my show, Timeless. We do a Thinker of the Month series, or sort of like a Observation of the Month series, which everyone should check out. And recently, we were talking about how different religions depict or don't depict God. So, for instance, in Christianity, among Catholics, it's customary to have a crucifix, but among many Protestant denominations, it's viewed as iconography to have a crucifix, so there's just a cross. In Judaism, and luckily I have you across from me to correct me if I get this wrong, you're not supposed to depict God because God is invisible, and you're not supposed to say Yahweh, but you can depict, you know, biblical figures.
Well, on the Yahweh thing, that's correct, by the way. So Jews have actually two steps. It's really amazing. Not only will they not say God's name as is written in the Torah or in the whole Hebrew Bible, it's four letters, and they will never pronounce those four letters. So what they say is Adonai, which means my Lord, which is why when it has God's proper name,
mm-hmm,
from King James on, it's the Lord. The Lord is not the same word as God. Lord is God's personal name, the four letters.
So you're not supposed to say Lord.
You can say Lord. You can't say what. I'm not even saying the four letters now.
I thought you just did, and that's not a gotcha, but
no,
Yahweh?
Well, yeah, but that's not how it's pronounced.
Oh, I see.
That's close.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, you know who, Michael Gottlieb taught me? He taught me that Hashem is my God or the God?
No, the name.
The name. That's what it is.
So that's what I was saying. That's the second degree. So if you're not praying or reading the Bible, you don't even say the substitute Lord. You just say the name. Mm. So it's 2 degrees separation from the actual name. So
can they hear him?
You know, I hope they hear him so that people will appreciate what I have to endure.
What about me?
On a daily basis. I've endured it for decades. You've endured it for a year.
Well, I voluntarily endure it on
How long is Timeless going on?
It's been a year and 2 months.
A year and 2 months?
It flies. It really flies, yeah.
Don't tell me about time flying. Yep.
But back to Arabic. So there's that, you know, crucifix issue, if you will, in Christianity. There's the don't depict a God or don't say God's name in Judaism. And in Islam, you are not supposed to have any depictions of God or the Prophet
Muhammad.
Or any other figures in the Quran. But this is the point about Arabic. And you're also not supposed to have music in mosques, which differs from Christianity and to an extent differs from Judaism. Yes, you're not supposed to have music. Double check me on that, Sean, but I'm nearly certain that's correct. But you know what? The Arabic calligraphy is sort of the art. And if you look at mosques, for instance, if you look at the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, there's beautiful Arabic calligraphy, you know, circumambulating the structure, and that is the substitute for art. That's supposed to artistically glorify God.
So what raised this issue?
Well, that's a great question. What did raise this issue?
It's fascinating.
You were saying Hebrew or Arabic,
yes,
or something.
No, no.
You
were talking about Mario Pai and Arabic not
so
having
true.
Vowels like Hebrew.
Yeah. Well, we got off on a tangent, but I just wanted to bring this subject up of the different ways that God is depicted, because I had a discussion with the Shabbat dinner crew about this a few days ago. And truthfully, I never saw it as a big deal to depict God. Like, I don't mean to disparage those who do view it as a big deal, but I didn't quite understand their reasoning. But I actually think the Shabbat dinner crew kind of convinced me that when you depict God, you're limiting. What they said is you're limiting him.
That's right.
But then again, I know as a.
Well, let's say there were no ban on depicting God in let's say Judaism. What would you draw? See, with Jesus, you can imagine a human figure. Jesus came as a human.
Right.
So, but no Christian, well, I guess Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel with reaching out to Adam, but nobody assumes God is this human with a beard. I mean people might imitate,
right.
But nobody seriously imagines that. How would you depict the invisible God? Let us say there were no ban. It's not depictable. It's like, how would you draw a black hole? I guess it's the best analogy I could give. You have a black canvas? Okay, that would be God then.
I know it's very powerful for me to walk into a Catholic church and see the crucifix because it immediately orients me with what the central issue is and the central sacrifice and redemption. So visually, that's very helpful for me. But as you say, you're right that depicting Christ, who was a human being, is different than depicting God. So, you know, another thing they said at Shabbat dinner was the reason why you don't say the full name of God, we're saying Yahweh, but as you say, right. It's not the exact thing, is that the name, you know, God is so powerful and so deserving of reverence that you shouldn't use his name superfluously. And that inspired me to kind of look at myself. And I do throw around the term God a lot. I'm sure I've said it. We're 5 minutes into this podcast. I'm sure I've said it. Oh my God, or dear God, or God damn. And I don't view that as disrespecting God. And as you say, one of the commandments, which says, do not take the Lord's name in vain, what they mean is not literally the word. They mean don't
carry.
Yes, carry the name of God and say you are acting on behalf of God if you are not truly acting on behalf of Him. But I think there is something to be said that we do very loosely throw around the term God just in our everyday lives with, oh my God, God damn. And maybe it is a little disrespectful.
What's the, okay, so Sean just looked up Islam and music.
It's a very complex and controversial
matter. The complex and controversial matter.
Many Muslims believe that the Quran and the Sunnah prohibit music, and other Muslims disagree and believe some forms of music are prohibited.
Okay, so it's a dispute within the Muslim world. Fine, but I it's true. I don't have any association of a mosque with music. There is obviously Arabic music.
Well, the call to prayer is musical.
That's right. That's right. It is. So what were you just saying prior to that?
That when
that we use God's name too often. Well, first of all, God isn't God's name. So I always try to explain that to people who say, well, Dennis, when you say, oh, my God, to a caller, you're using God's name in vain. But God's name isn't God. God has a name. So... If people did use what people say, let's say Jehovah, that's God's name. It's not the exact way it is in the Torah. For those terribly curious, it's a Y instead of a J. That's how you would. But I, as a believing Jew, I don't say that name. But Jehovah is very close. So. What can I say? I'm a very big believer in gradations of sin.
Oh, definitely.
And I know you are.
I don't view it as a sin.
Yeah, well, some do.
I know they do.
There are.
I disagree with them.
Since my beginning of my radio career, I've been getting mail, first mail, now email, of, Dennis, you're such a God-centered religious man. How can you say, oh, my God, like that? And first of all, I had never been told that in Jewish religious life. No, nobody ever raised the issue. And I realize Christians are much more sensitive to that issue. I respect that. But I do want to make clear, God isn't God's name. So if you say, as I would, somebody calls me up and they say, Dennis, you know, let's say we're talking about the loss of a child. Because I talk about painful issues on the Happiness Hour, ironically.
Right.
And they will say, well, you know, I lost my daughter in a car crash 2 years ago. And I'll go, oh, my God, my heart goes out to you. So.
Oh, it's ridiculous to pick on that.
But they would.
I know they would.
Yes.
I disagree. I think the reason why I'm raising this point is that one of the things I really admire, I've come to admire about Judaism through my exposure to Shabbat dinners and all that, is that With the Sabbath, there's a ritual every week where time is sanctified and you orient your behavior around God. You're not supposed to you drive, but you know, you're not supposed to work. You're not supposed to use a lot of technology. And
I want to make clear, I drive to Shabbat events.
Right.
Synagogue and Shabbat meal.
Right. And you use your phone to pull up something if you want to show us. But you know,
it's always to related. A Shabbat issue, right.
But I appreciate that because I think it's important to have not an excess of rituals, but some rituals or things that you abide by in the week which remind you of God's presence and your obligations to Him. And I at least have not experienced a big counterpart with that in Christianity. Now, rituals can go way too far, but the reason I bring up this God issue is that it's just something that I'm trying to consider in my daily life, maybe not using the term God as superfluously as I do in order to give God the appropriate reverence He deserves.
I think it's beautiful. I have no issue with that. Dennis Prager here with a man I have come to admire for his work. So when I asked him, what do you do? This is the title he gave, Wealth Architect.
Very simply put, I am a wealth architect that helps my clients accelerate the way they grow your wealth. It's not how much you make, it's how much you keep. The Internal Revenue Code is embedded with a number of things that you can take advantage of. It's what I call playing tax chess. We take the time to play tax chess in your favor. We give our clients unbiased, independent advice across all areas in their financial life because we have no incentive to sell anything.
I was taken enough and impressed enough to have you do my work. And you have, in fact, saved me a serious amount of money. CharlesDombeck.com/Prager. The ritual issue is really one that only of all faiths, maybe on earth, it's really only Protestant Christianity that is largely ritual-free. Catholicism is not, Judaism is not, Islam is not, Buddhism is not.
What do you make of that?
I don't make anything of it. I don't have a judgment on it. I want to fill in that sentence, but I made the point only because I think people will find it interesting. Because everyone, this is the way life works. What you experience, you assume is the norm. When when I discovered this, my third year in college, I was in England. And first of all, obviously, it was the first time I had been in a car on the left side of the road. And so I had to confront the very obvious. It's obvious if you think about it, but it became obvious and important to me. There's no right or wrong about which side you drive on. The left or right side. That's purely cultural, but what the way True. You grow up is the norm.
Yes.
So for Protestant Christians, it is normal not to have religious ritual. But it is not normal in any religion on earth, that I'm aware of.
Well, you know who it would especially behoove to be reminded of this very important point, that you think your life is the norm?
Yes.
Left-wing Americans.
Go on.
Who excoriate the United States, who say that we are a systemically racist, patriarchal, homophobic society. They have no idea what a staggering accomplishment this country is and the way that their lives are and with all of the flaws America has, the way that their lives are leaps and bounds above everyone else's lives in the history of planet Earth. But we fall into this assumption where we just think freedom of speech, freedom of religion, as women being able to wear our hair down, go into a beauty salon, we think those things are the norm.
That's right. It's true for the West generally, but certainly for the United States.
Yep.
So that, by the way, it's ironic because I mentioned this realization I had when my first exposure really to the rest of the world was in England in my junior year in college. And it shaped my thinking. For example, I mean, there were all these little things. I had it slightly in America in high school. On occasion, I would go to a friend's house for the weekend. And I remember the first time I was at a friend's house, and they put the mother put mustard on the table.
Oh my gosh, this is so weird. I was about to say this exact thing.
You're kidding.
Mustard.
Me. Yes, mustard.
I was about to use that same thing.
It was a different brand.
Yes, and you're
than
like
my home, and I go,
you don't use the same?
That is so weird. You use Goldens, we use French's.
So funny. I was literally about to
So
bring up
I
that.
Have called it the French's mustard syndrome all of my life. The same thing when I went into their bathroom to brush my teeth.
The toothpaste.
They had Colgate toothpaste. Yeah. We had Crest. And I thought, Colgate? Why did they use Colgate?
It's like they're aliens from another planet.
People need to understand. This is not a trivial issue. So at an early age, I had to confront, whoa, there are many ways of doing things.
Yeah.
The only thing that needs to be universal is moral standards. cultural stuff, have a great time. Drive on the left side. Use a different mustard. Use a different toothpaste. The Japanese wash their hands before they go to the bathroom.
Really?
Yes, that's right.
Oh, God. These kinds of things fascinate me. Oh, it's the language thing. That's why I love Mario Pi's book.
Exactly. So I'll give you another example of when this whole thing, when I got this really healthy perspective on my own life, that I was about 25, and I was my first trip to Hungary, because I went to communist countries a lot. Maybe 24.
Wow.
And I'm sitting in a park just watching people walk by. And a Hungarian guy is walking with his dog. Have I told you this?
No.
Oh, you'll love this. I have such a vivid memory of this. So the guy is talking to his dog in Hungarian. And my reaction was, is this guy an idiot? He thinks his dog speaks Hungarian. And I realized, wait a minute, I think my dog speaks English.
I know.
Why is that any bit more coherent?
Oh, I so know these moments that you're talking
about. They're so important.
They're really important. Yes, because it's a necessary slap in the face to yourself.
Yes, exactly. I laughed at myself. I think it took 30 seconds till I thought, hey, Dennis, you're an idiot.
Well, I'll tell you where this really came to the fore for me. So I recently did an interview with an individual in India, which is so cool to
Oh, the best.
It's really yes. cool. But he was great. We had a great conversation about conservatism. But, you know, whenever I've had limited exposure in international audiences, mainly I've had exposure in Britain, Australia, and then now India. But I always try to orient myself as far as their audience, you know, and even with the kind of language that I use, I'm just aware of it in the back of my head. And so we were talking on this this India interview about what has made the United States great. And I was rattling off, you know, all of these things, you know, the outsized value that we placed on the nuclear family, you know, respect for the rule of law, patriotism, freedom of speech, a capitalist, you know, economic system. And then I got to freedom of religion. And I realized, I paused for a moment because I'm not speaking about this interviewer specifically, but many of, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but it occurred to me that perhaps there were some audience members in India who would not view freedom of religion as virtuous as perhaps we view it, because many are Hindu and, you know, want a Hindu majority state and a state where the laws and the kind of culture are very embedded in Hinduism. And so, again, it was just like, it was just interesting for me to think about that. You know, we consider freedom of religion to be a universal,
fundamental and universal
value
good, yeah.
that everyone endeavors to have, but that's not true.
Exactly. Well, if I'd have known you were going to interview someone in India, I would have asked
They interviewed
you,
me.
That's even nicer.
Oh no! If I had interviewed them, I would have asked a lot of things.
Oh well, I would like to know what you would have. But here's a fascinating one. Does any school in India teach about what Muslims did in the 1,000-year rule of Muslims in
India? I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure not.
Really? I disagree with that.
Oh, okay, fine. Then I'll give you my evidence.
Okay.
The lead historian in India in the 50s, I believe it was, the head of history at their major university, whatever it might have been, wrote about how many tens of millions of Hindus were killed by Muslims. An estimate of about 60 million over the course of 1,000 years. The what was done to Indians, Hindus by Muslim and Muslim rule is one of the horrors of human history. If you try to find that on the internet,
definitely.
It is essentially invisible. And I've been to India a number of times. They are so afraid of teaching this to Hindu children because it might cause tension with Muslims who make up, I think, a quarter of the country.
20%.
Okay, so fifth of the country. Well, no. Yeah, fifth of the country. That it is simply put aside. They don't want riots between Muslims and Hindus. So that's why do you think they do teach that?
Well, I don't claim to be any expert on India, but I have done a lot of reading on Prime Minister Narendra Modi and the BJP party and their efforts to...
By the way, is it Modi or Modi? I don't know
the
answer.
I call him Modi. Uh-huh. Maybe it's Modi.
I don't know.
I've never heard Modi.
Oh, then it's... okay. I haven't heard either. Okay, go ahead.
Well, he and his party are endeavoring to really make India a Hindu nationalist state.
Right.
They just opened this temple they just opened a temple in one of the northern provinces to honor the Hindu god Ram, and that was where a mosque stood. And in the 90s, a Hindu mob raised the mosque. There was, obviously Hindu and Muslim conflict there, and then the mosque was demolished, and then a new Hindu, Modi and the party re-erected a Hindu temple honoring the god Ram. Now, they claim that the Hindu temple stood there, and then when the Mughal Empire, the
Mughal.
Muslim... Really? I think it's Mughal.
I think it's Mughal.
Well, I think it's Modi.
He was saying Modi, right?
So, I know that.
It's not Modi.
I know
it?
It's Modi. Yes, I say. You say you're right. It is Modi.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. By the way, take a look. Isn't it M O G H U L?
M U G H A L. I think.
Wow.
What's wow?
No, that I got it wrong for all of my life. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Anyway, go on.
Well, they say that there was the Hindu, temple to the god Ram before, and then Muslims
Mughal.
Came in and destroyed it, and then.
Or what is it?
Mughal.
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 Wow. Maybe I'm thinking of Hollywood.
Well, you
moguls.
can read Arabic. I can't, so.
Right, but I can't read Hindi. Okay.
Anyway, my point is, I've read a lot about Modi and the party and their efforts to because India was a secular state for a lot of its post-colonial history after 1947. Indira Gandhi. Ravid Gandhi, her son, they were all kind of wanting to make India into a secular state. And the whole appeal of Modi.
Nehru as well, I assume.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The whole appeal of Modi is wanting to make it into a Hindu nationalist state. So that's why I said I'm not so sure that anymore they're not teaching the Muslim history.
The reason it's irrelevant whether India is more Hindu or secular, they're afraid of riots.
Well, I've heard Modi talk about the quote 2000 year history of India. He talks a lot about the British and the Muslim colonial rule. So I think that might be changing, but I take your point.
Yeah. By the way, since this is classic of us, who thought we'd be talking about India? But the points are much larger than any of this. So people ask me that there's literally one thing I brag about, and you know what it is. The number of countries I've visited.
Yeah.
It's the only thing.
I thought you were going to say your fountain pen collection.
I don't, because people would think I'm weird. Or at least eccentric, which there may be
nothing
some truth
wrong with
to that.
That.
Yes, I'm totally fine with it. But I'm asked, when people find out how many countries I've been to, they will ask me, so... what's your favorite country to visit? The most common question I get. And there is no answer.
Your answer would be all of them, I think.
Overwhelmingly. But I do have two favorites to visit.
There are many good reasons to buy gold and silver. bank failures, digital currency volatility, emerging market countries trying to topple the dollar as a global reserve currency. Julie Hartman here for AmFed Coin and Bullion, Dennis's choice for precious metals. If you ask AmFed owner Nick Rovich to simplify the case for precious metals, he'll tell you that when President Roosevelt recalled the gold in circulation and paid people with paper money, they received a $20 bill for a $20 gold piece. Today, that $20 bill won't even fill half of your gas tank, but the gold piece is worth about $2,000. Which would you rather own? Now let's simplify the reasons to use AmFed Coin and Bullion. Nick has been in the industry for over 42 years, and he's proud of providing transparency and fair pricing to build trusted relationships. If you're interested in buying or selling, call Nick and his team at AmFed Coin and Bullion, 1-800-221-7694, AmericanFederal.com, AmericanFederal.com.
I do have two favorites to visit, India and Israel. And I've thought many times, because this is how your mind works and my mind works. Okay, Dennis, why are they so interesting, those two countries? They have, would seem to have very little in common other than starting with the letter I. And then I realized they're the only two countries in the world with their own religion. The Hindu country, I'm not talking, you know, Sri Lanka, but the Hindu country is India. The Jewish country
is
Israel.
It's the sole country of the, yeah.
Yes, isn't that interesting? So it makes for a different world.
Right.
Obviously, Israel and India are both very westernized, but and Israel more so. But still, in religious areas of Israel, you've entered another world. And in India, I mean, you could be walking down a beautiful street in some Indian city window shopping, and you turn around and there's a cow next to you. That doesn't happen anywhere on Earth.
Oh, gosh, I'm so excited to go to India
one day. Oh, you've got to go to India.
So,
but it begs the question, which was your least favorite country?
Okay. Sean's a troublemaker. I actually have an answer, but I'm not saying it.
Oh, come on. It's Dennis and Julie.
I'm sorry. It's not if it was just Dennis and Julie.
Why?
Because I don't want to insult a country.
You wouldn't be insulting
I
a
would,
country.
I would.
Oh.
What is it wrong
I'm
with?
So sorry to do this to the listeners, but the second we're done, I'm asking you.
No, I feel terrible because I say everything in public.
Okay, it's okay.
But the only reason is I have nothing against this particular country. I just didn't find it interesting. The people were nice. Okay.
I have a guess. No, actually, I'm not going to go there.
Okay. All right.
Anyway.
Yes.
Okay. So I thought you were going to say something a little different. So I've been to Israel, never been to India, but I was amazed when I went to Israel, dazzled, transformed, and amazed. And of course, it's because of the religious. I mean, being in Jerusalem was like being in spiritual Disneyland. It was incredibly moving to me. And when people would say this, I would have respect for it, but I wouldn't quite understand what they were talking about when people would say that you feel the holiness, but you really do feel it in Jerusalem. So there's that. But really what dazzled me about Israel were the people. I was so taken aback in the best way by their vitality. Just every, like, you know, the leaders of our trip who were Harvard Israeli students, the people we'd meet at restaurants, they're, you know, people we'd meet up out at clubs, at, you know, at lectures, anything. They were so spirited. They were patriotic. They were real. They were tough, but they were fun. And I loved that, you know, at every single dinner or meal, you raise a glass and you go, L'chaim, to life. And I realized that's really at the center of Israelis, they know about life in a way that Americans don't, because they have to serve in the army and they have daily threats to their existence. I mean, everyone in Israel has had a relative who has died either in the Holocaust or, you know, fighting in the IDF, especially now in a post, you know, October 7th world. But I realized they have texture and nuance and understanding and vitality in a way that Americans don't. Americans, at least in my view, in comparison to Israelis, were very deadened and boring. What do you make of that?
There are many issues. First, let me start with the last one. Americans have become deadened.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. It wasn't always that way.
At all. The left has a deadening impact on people. Do you know, I can tell you in 2 minutes, if a kid comes from a conservative home, if a kid was homeschooled, and you know what the most glaring characteristic is? They're not jaded.
Oh, yeah.
Jaded is deadened. So we'll put the American part aside. I like Israelis.
I love Israelis.
Well, you love them, and I totally get it. Often people come back, I love Israel, I love Israel, I love Israel, and I'm glad they do, obviously, and I get it. But you are right about Israelis, and they're flawed like every other human
being. Of
course,
yes.
But you are right. Do you know that Israel, prior to October 7th, was regularly voted among the happiest countries in the world, and by far the happiest in the Middle East?
Why is that, in your view?
Because they're very life-affirming.
Yes.
And that, I give credit to Judaism. L'chaim is not to life. I mean, people who see Fiddler on the Roof probably know the song, to life, l'chaim, 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 to life. That, there is a tremendous life-centered aspect to Judaism. Judaism believes in an afterlife, but it is overwhelmingly preoccupied with making this a good and happy life.
Well, one of the things that you taught me is that, is it in the Talmud or other rabbinic tradition where there are five questions
that
God will ask
Talmud,
you
yes.
when you die?
Yes.
And one of them is, why did you not partake in the joys of life? In every permitted pleasure.
Right. It's a sin not to enjoy life. Isn't that amazing?
It really is amazing.
And they have children. It's how many Western countries are they reproducing and then some their own population?
Listen, I totally agree with you about the deadening nature of the left. And by the way, I want to say quickly, because a few minutes ago I said that it would behoove left-wing Americans to know that their reality is not the norm. What I really meant was leftists. As you often say, liberals are different from leftists. And so in this conversation, I also agree that the left, as in leftist project in America, has been very deadening. However, I do think that another component of this, of our deadening, is that we have been swaddled in prosperity and security and affluence. And thank God we have been. All of us are the beneficiaries of that. But I think it has made us liberal, conservative, left-wing, all of us. I think it has made us spoiled and disconnected from the reality of life, and thus deadened in a way that Israelis are not. Because Israelis have daily threats to their existence. We don't, by comparison. I mean, that's changing now. You know, the reality in America with crime, with fentanyl, all of that is changing things. But you take my point that we've had it pretty damn good for the past few decades here, certainly compared to Israel. So I think that's where a lot of the vitality comes from.
So, you know, this really is an intelligent point. I mean, I feel silly saying that the point you make is intelligent.
I'll take it.
You make a lot of them. But what I am noting is, it's a provocative point, and I'd like to affirm why you might be well right, why you might well be right. Americans were much happier in the Depression and World War II than they are today. The depression rates and suicide rates are much higher today. No depression, no World War. And Americans are considerably less happy today.
Okay. I have a theory about this that I feel like is a very Dennis Prager theory, and I said it on my show the other day, Timeless. It fascinates me how there are so many Americans today who view themselves as victims, and they have been through nothing, nothing.
Right.
And meanwhile, real victims,
yes,
you know, those in the Depression, those in World War II, right now, you know, victims of terrible atrocities all around the world, they don't view themselves as victims. And the main person I think of with regard to this is Alexei Navalny, who, as we all know, recently died. And I did...
was recently probably killed.
That's right. Thank you. That's a much, much more accurate way of saying it. He was murdered by the Kremlin. But I did this whole segment on Timeless about... this guy had such humor up mm-hmm. until the day he died. Literally
yes.
the day before he died, he is
right.
there's a video of him in a cell with handcuffs, and he's making some joke, and it's not an act. You can really see his mirth. He's making a joke to the judge, and he goes, you know, Mr. Judge, I was hoping that you could wire transfer some of your money into my account because I'm not doing particularly well financially in here. Like he was always kind of sticking it to them. And at his funeral, he requested that Terminator 2, the music from that movie, be played, which is kind of, it was his favorite movie. And I just love that guy because not only was he...
He was full of life.
He was full of life and he was filled
with
humor.
And his enemies are full of death.
Well, what I said was, Alexei Navalny teaches us that humor is a weapon. They could take everything from him, his family, his freedom, his dignity, but they could not take away his spirit. Mm. And that was his weapon against them. It was the ultimate FU to the Russian regime. Anyway, my point about victimhood is, again, this, like, how does someone like Alexei Navalny not view himself as a victim, but then, you know, the average American college student goes to pieces and thinks that they have been through unimaginable trauma because they were microaggressed? And the answer is, in a way, it's kind of a luxury to view yourself as a victim. True victims can't really view themselves as victims because then they will just slide down a hole of despair. And you know who really hammered that home for me? My best friend in the world, Mahtab, who is the son of Bengali immigrants. Both of his parents died. He raises his 12-year-old sister. He was an orphan before he turned 20. And he is the most happy-go-lucky, great person I've ever met. You would never know what he's been through. And I asked him once, recently, I said, how do you do this? Like, how do you not just lie on the couch and sit in a fetal position and cry after all that you've been through? And his answer to me was, I didn't have a choice.
That's exactly right.
I don't have a choice. I have to be there for my sister, and I have to be, like, my
right.
life has to go on. I can't yes. view myself as a victim.
Right. It's a luxury to be able to do. That's excellent. You're batting, always batting. Today you're really on fire.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think I was.
I think it's the green dress.
You think this is green? I think this is gray.
Okay, so you're... I hope my wife doesn't watch this episode.
Why?
Because she's convinced I have colorblindness.
I'm convinced I have colorblindness.
Green and gray. Sean, is her dress green or gray?
Gray.
Boy, I really see it as green.
I'm a little colorblind.
That's fascinating.
I get greens and
That's
blues
really
confused.
Gray?
Yes.
I don't see any.
I will admit, I see a little bit of green in here.
It's all I see is green. It's very fascinating. Anyway, this victim thing?
It's everything.
A woman called my show. You know how few calls I remember? And I've had tens of thousands, right? But here is one of the maybe 10 that I remember in 40 years. Woman calls me on the Happiness Hour. I even remember from where? Brooklyn. Oh, no. It wasn't Brooklyn. It was from the Philadelphia area. She called Dennis. I got to just tell you this. My mother was a Holocaust survivor. My father is American born. He's the depressed one, and my mother is the happy one. She lost her whole family in the Holocaust. She's the happy one. She's the happy parent. The guy who lost nobody is moody.
Well, it's because when you have something terrible happen to you, you have two roads in front of you. You can either send in your resignation letter to life.
That's right.
Or you can keep going forward. And if you choose the latter road of continuing forward, you cannot view yourself as a victim. You don't have that luxury. Even if you are a victim, you have to think of yourself in different terms.
Are you ready to lose weight but not sure where to start? So let me tell you why I, not just I, but my colleagues who got me to do this, my colleagues Seb Gorka and Mike Gallagher, chose PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition. First, Dr. Ashley Lucas has her PhD in Chronic Disease and Sports Nutrition. The program is science-based. The PhD program starts with nutrition, but is much more. They know that 90% of permanent change comes from the mind, and they work on eliminating the reason you gained weight in the first place. There are no shortcuts, no pills, no injections, just solid science-based nutrition and behavior change. It's been terrific for me. If you are ready to lose weight for the last time, call 864-644-1900 to get started, or online at myphdweightloss.com. Do what I did and just make the appointment for your one-on-one consultation. Call today. That's 864-644-1900, 864-644-1900. So in light of everything we're saying, and in light of my point about much fewer suicides during the Depression than today, so here you know I've asked this question, but now it has more legitimacy. I have asked on the air, is it a blessing?
Oh yes.
Have a happy childhood. To which people will go, are you nuts? Because it's a blessing to have a happy childhood. Now, it's no blessing to be abused. Okay, it's
a curse.
But a childhood without misery may not be a blessing.
I mean, I think in all of the right ways, I had a great childhood. My parents are the most loving, secure, you know, people ever. But I was utterly miserable for years of my life with swimming. Years. And there were times when I was...
I'll never forget that you cried in your goggles.
I did. It was horrible. I hated it. I hated it so much. And it was like torture for me. I just hated it. And there were also times when I was, you know, our whole family was miserable because of what was going on with my sister Gina and the terrible care that she was facing. But you know what? I look back on those things, especially the swimming. I'm so grateful.
Wow.
I am so grateful that I was miserable for so many years swimming and I cried into my goggles. It has made the rest of life, and especially uncomfortable or difficult situations, nothing. And it's also made, you know, having that really disciplined, rigid childhood too, for me, has made working hard not hard, if that makes sense.
Oh,
like working hard is a feature,
this.
Not so, an effort.
Here's my parallel. Through high school, I went to a yeshiva, which is an advanced Orthodox Jewish school. You have half the day in Hebrew, religious subjects, half the day in English, secular subject.
Mm-hmm.
So literally double the number of hours, double the curriculum, double the work. When I went to college, and it would be 2, maybe 3 hours a day, I thought... They got to be kidding.
I know.
I thought of college as a 4-year vacation. I'm not joking.
I know you're not.
Which after high school it was.
Right, yes. Oh, well, can you imagine? When I was in college and 3 p.m. would roll around and I didn't have to dive into a pool, I remember thinking, this is the life. This is the best thing
right.
in the world.
Yeah, I never had the, I didn't have to dive into a pool. I had the equivalent. But yes, so my question
Oh, it's
if
yeah.
you have this easy childhood, maybe easy is better than happy. If you have this easy childhood, that's not a blessing. You don't build antibodies.
Yeah.
It's like if you never
get a
cold.
Way to put it. I'll tell you another thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately. It's not a good thing to be universally liked. people, especially I've noticed people my age, really endeavor to be beloved by everyone. As someone who has very much gone through a fall from grace among many in my, you know, there are many people, my high school community, college community, who viewed me as lovely, fantastic. And then when I became conservative and started doing this commentary, it's like, oh my God, this was not the Julie I thought I knew. How could she? You know, I've had to face that. And let me tell you, it's strangely so liberating to not be liked by some people. I don't seek to be, you shouldn't seek to be universally liked.
Well, at the very least, you learned I can handle it.
Totally. And you know what? I mean, it's a blessing for many reasons because, you know, mainly it makes you figure out who your real friends are, and that is everything. But it kind of also gives me permission to do whatever I want because I know they already hate me. You know? It's sort of like, well, you're off, you know, the reservation here. You're never going to like me anyway, no matter what I do. I might as well continue forward. But here's also the thing I've come to, and this is so important. I wish I better understood this, you know, 5 years ago. If you are doing something morally, if you're doing something moral, or if you're doing something courageous, you are going to be disliked. It is a guarantee. Who throughout history has ever done anything good and not faced insurmountable opposition? This is why I adore Christianity, have immense respect and reverence for it. That is the central story of Jesus Christ. Here we had the most righteous person on earth who was just trying to do good for everyone, and he was put on a cross. It is a guarantee that you're going to encounter opposition if you're doing the right thing. And that's so comforting because it's like, okay, Julie, you know, every day you wake up, you try to do your best, you try to do what's good for your country. And if people are hating you for that, weirdly, it's a sign that you're doing something right if you're ticking them off.
That's right. What? People, how shall I put this? I spend a lot of time in airports, but even if I go out of the house, there is no day that someone will not come by and say something sweet to me, a stranger, and perhaps ask for a selfie. So this is a common line I get. Dennis, I just want you to know we love you. Their family, or speaking on behalf of somebody else, boyfriend, girlfriend, doesn't matter, or I love you. But they always add, but you hear that all the time. To which many years ago, I actually came up with this answer. Actually, I also hear the opposite all the time.
Well, do
wait. Let me just give the my. You'll love this. You don't know my response. Oh, you will love this. So I actually say to them, I mean, unless there are little kids around, I will say, you know what? Google Dennis Prager and see how many tens of thousands of hits you get. They totally crack up. And it's true. So, obviously I resonate to what Sikhs. I am the object of a vast amount of hatred and vast amount of love, to which, of course, you know this, I think. I've developed this really great lesson in life. If you let the compliments go to your head, you will let the insults go to your heart.
Yeah, you have to maintain a sort of neutrality with regard to all of it.
Exactly. I deeply appreciate every kind comment, but they absolutely don't go to my head. It's likewise, the others curse me out all you like, fascist, this. It just means I'm having an effect. When I was on Bill Maher's show, and the whole audience laughed at me, Bill Maher laughed at me, And the panel laughed at me when I said, you think Donald Trump lies? Look at how the left lies. He goes, what do you mean? Well, they say America's systemically racist, and they say men menstruate. And he goes, this is, by the way, gone viral. There were maybe 10 million views of this on the internet. And he goes, what? Who says men menstruate? And he starts laughing. And the whole audience is laughing. And I'm thinking, I know I'm right. They're going to laugh at themselves.
Totally. I study you and other courageous, principled people. And I try to figure out where does that come from? Because that's not easy, even though you know you're right, to sit in an, you know, on national television live and be laughed at by the host and by the audience. That's not an amazing feeling, no matter how right you are. And so I look at stuff like that and I go, okay, what is animating that person? And I think it's two things. First, it's what you just said about having a kind of neutrality or indifference to the love and to the hate. But I think there's a second component of courage, thinking long term, knowing that what you're doing now is going to age well. And that has been kind of my like, I remember being at Harvard and writing that article about the COVID lockdowns, which was, even though I in the moment knew that I was right, it was insane to, you know, mask us as we're getting our food, but then allow us to take off the mask as we're eating our food, as if COVID only lives where the food is and not where the, you know, dining table. I knew I was right about all of it, but still it was immensely unpopular. And I remember whenever I do something controversial or taking a risk, I tell myself one thing: this is going to age well. Think about that. Don't think about the here and now. Think about 3 years from now when you can go, yeah, that's right. I wrote an article about the crazy COVID restrictions, and now you see that they're crazy. I knew it 3 years ago. What? You have to think long term.
Julie, you are so great today.
I really don't think I'm not.
No. You don't have to respond.
Thank
you. That is a very, very wise observation. And, you know, I mean, that's not hidden from the audience how much, not only do I adore you, but I see me in you, which has happened very rarely in my life. At beginning in high school, I thought long term.
Yep.
It was built into me. I don't even take credit. That is how my mind worked. I thought in high school, and I was already a happy kid then, I thought, you know, I'm going to die. So that's when I developed my belief that if there is a good God, there is an afterlife. It's an axiom. It's not a belief. It's an axiom. It's a belief there's a good God. But it's not a belief that if there's a good God, there's an afterlife.
Right.
That's so, I knew that then because I thought of that. But on a personal level, I remember thinking, how will I want to look back at my life when I'm old?
Yes.
And I am living that now. And I thank God or thank luck or thank whatever, that I thought that way, because I can look back at a certain amount of good that I've done, at having children and grandchildren, and a community, all that matters. I've been divorced, as everybody knows. I got married, my first marriage was because I could not continue to think, I'm not going to live a bachelor life anymore. This is empty. So I got married more out of, I want to get married. I want to make a home. I want to advance in life. And she's a wonderful woman. We're still very close. And, but she was not for me and I was not for her. Okay, so fine. So we divorced. But I knew I don't want to look back if I can do anything about a childless. And then for my second child, pregnancy was not an option for my second wife.
Hmm.
And so I said, oh, then we'll adopt. It took me 2 seconds.
And look what a blessing you got.
And
out
look
of
what
that.
Yes, exactly. But that's why when I meet young people and they're so career preoccupied. It's not like I haven't had a good career, but I knew what really will matter in the long term. And they don't, because they're not, there's no long-term thinking. That's Tom Sowell's great point. He calls it
stage one
thinking. This is what characterized the left-wing mindset. What feels good now?
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? You're going to get old one day. You're going to look back at being the head of sales for Neiman Marcus or some, you know, I'm just
right.
picking, I have
right.
nothing against Neiman Marcus. That's going to bring you meaning at the end?
Yes. No, it's, I think it's the key to everything, and especially courage. Knowing that what you are doing and what you are saying is going to age well.
That's right.
Oh gosh. Bingo, Dennis and Julie. I had a point, but I forgot it.
No, there's so much going on that it's
I know, my
totally
mind
understand.
Is racing.
Yes, me too. Dennis Prager here with a man I have come to admire for his work. So when I asked him, what do you do? This is the title he gave, Wealth Architect.
Very simply put, I am a wealth architect that helps my clients accelerate the way they grow your wealth. It's not how much you make, it's how much you keep. The Internal Revenue Code is embedded with a number of things that you can take advantage of. It's what I call playing tax chess. We take the time to play tax chess in your favor. We give our clients unbiased, independent advice across all areas in their financial life because we have no incentive to sell anything.
I was taken enough and impressed enough to have you do my work. And you have, in fact, saved me a serious amount of money. CharlesDombeck.com/Prager.
Oh.
Go on.
No. I'll remember it.
No, I'm just... I was only going to repeat that long-term thinking. You're right. That I'd never... That's why I said I was so admiring of your point. I never associated that with courage.
Oh,
I associated it with meaning. That was a very intelligent point.
I think it is the key ingredient of courage, really. Because, again, Alexei Navalny, talk about thinking long term. He thought long term beyond his time here on Earth, you know?
Which was relatively brief. What was he, 40?
47, I think. But, you know, he thought he was going to orient his actions for what would be best for his legacy long term and, more importantly, to him than his legacy was for Russia long term. But no, all courageous people, consciously or not, do that. They think long term. But, you know, another way that I see this, you're talking about thinking long term, not just with regard to your career, but with regard to your personal life. That is a hugely important point because and I have tended to at times fall into this trap. I hope I'm rectifying it, but I think a lot of people my age, we think long term professionally. We think long term with at least people I went to school with, kind of placing ourselves well as far as graduate school or, you know, subsequent degrees that we would get. But there's not that similar thinking long term with getting married and having kids and making yourself into a deep, rich, good person. Like, I know this sounds weird, but sometimes I will purposefully put myself in challenging or uncomfortable situations because I view it as a kind of like resistance training. What? Why are you laughing?
Am I speaking to myself?
Maybe.
When I was...
Because that's going to benefit me long term,
yes.
You know? Like,
I always
make it hard for
myself.
Yourself now. It's
yes.
It's literally like resistance
yes.
training at the gym. And then later in life, when you're, you know, 30 or when you're 40, you're going to encounter a similar situation and it's going to be nothing. Why wouldn't you try to build that muscle now so that you're coasting long term?
God, such a joy. Again, I thought if it was easy, it was probably a mistake.
Oh, my God, yes. So, I think it's a trap. I think I'm missing. No, I do this in a – like, even if Waze tells me the driving app to go home, like, a fast way, I'm like, no, there's something wrong with that. There's going to be an accident. I always think the easy way is a trap.
I remember –
And most of the time, I think it is.
One year, driving. I asked a couple of friends – talking about our summer plans. So they said, so what are you doing, Dennis? Oh, I'm gonna go to Europe. And I said, you want to come with me? It's fun to travel with a friend. I said, well, Dennis, that sounds great. Where are you going? I said, Bulgaria. I give you my word. And the guy goes, where else? I go, Romania.
That's so cool.
Yes. You weren't my friend. Most people thought, I think I'll get some sun in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
And I thought, my God, there's an option to see Eastern Europe, which nobody goes to, see communism, and I'm going to lie in the sun in Puerto Rico?
Well, you know what? I think about this so much. Establishing good habits, especially in my age, is really important. And then things become second nature to you. Like, I'll give you an example. Reading. I talk on the show all the time about all the books that I'm reading, but when people write into me and they go, Julie, I so admire your love of reading, it almost doesn't ring true to me because it's like, I hated reading for most of my life. I was in remedial.
I didn't know that.
Oh, I did not like reading. It literally until I graduated from college. Dennis, I was in remedial reading when I was in third grade. I not only hated it, I really struggled with it. But I remember thinking when I graduated, especially with this job, like, push yourself to read. And now really I'm reaping the benefits of it because it's easier to read long passages. It's just, there are just those things, and working out is another thing. I mean, I'm not spectacular at that, but trying to establish good habits, because eventually, if you're thinking long term, they will become a fixture in your life and they will no longer be an effort and you will reap the rewards indefinitely.
So none of this is taught anymore.
Oh boy, is that a really good point. Yeah.
And the reason is no wisdom is taught.
Well, you know what? I actually could use your help with this. I'm trying to do a segment on Timeless about character education in American public schools, because my understanding is that up until maybe the mid-20th century, stuff like that, like character
totally.
Used to be
yes.
taught.
Yes.
So I don't know a lot about that, but you're saying it.
Oh, I know a lot about it. By the way, David Brooks, no comment, but David Brooks.
David Brooks, no comment.
Well, because I have mixed feelings. I'm sure he has mixed feelings about me, but it doesn't matter. He wrote a piece on character education.
Oh.
He's a New York Times columnist. I'll find it for you, or you'll find it. Just giving a terrific synopsis. I think it was actually, I don't think.
In the
I think
Atlantic?
It was in the Atlantic.
Oh, I saw that, yeah.
It's phenomenal. The, what was it, McDuffie's Reader and other things. So I actually said, you know, I wish we went back to early 20th century education. So what did the left do? Prager wants to teach racism. Is that sick? Is that what I'm referring to? Well, is that what they taught in schools? Hate people of other colors?
Also, even if some of that was taught, aren't you allowed to look at the good that was taught and
Correct.
Want to pick that?
Yes.
But here's the problem. Many leftists, they immediately view the past as bad.
That's right.
Everything in the past has to be bad. There's nothing redeeming.
That's right.
But we are so enlightened now. Yes, we who trans the kids and give kids puberty blockers. We're right. the moral titans of the world.
Right. Raising the unhappiest generation of young people since they took records of young people's happiness.
Yep. No, I so want to do this. But here's the thing about character education. Many would say now that they're doing a character education.
Yeah, because they have made character into macro issues. If you have the right opinion.
Oh, that's a good point.
Oh, this is a huge
point.
That's
very, very well
said. If you have the right position on global warming,
yeah.
you're a good person. Not are you honest in your business dealings or don't cheat on tests. Not if you treat other people that you meet decently. Not if you have personal integrity. Not if you want to make a family. Do you have the right position?
That is true. You're right. It's macro.
Yes.
Because, you know, I struggle with this because I'm a big believer in boundaries. You know, school is supposed to have its purpose. You're your parents are supposed to have their purpose, your church, etc. And we now have these blurring of distinctions where school is supposed to be parent and political education and character education, etc. So I'm in favor of, again, keeping things in their place. But yeah, I would support a good character education in public schools. But does that make me a hypocrite that I would support my version of character education in public schools, but not their version of it?
No, because you're not opposed to character education. You're opposed to bad character education.
Right. I'm just trying to go back to the principle. My principle is there should be boundaries.
It's like if I'm opposed to people breathing in dirty air, does that make me a hypocrite for being for clean air?
What if someone would say to you,
yeah,
all character education should be relegated to the home and the school should just teach
fine
you how to read, how
okay
to do math, et cetera?
I'll live with that. That's fine with me. Be such an improvement over today.
That's so true.
Absolutely. But the schools did believe in character education, and the homes did. Every home had, the poorest home had a Bible.
You know,
that was what they used at home to teach character.
Maybe it was you who told me this, or maybe it was Dion. I can't remember, but one of you told me that you used to go on a plane, and they'd have
you
Bibles.
So, no, not Bibles.
Or
Alaska
the sticker
Airlines,
yeah,
on your tray when they used to serve in coach. They used to serve meals. Gone. And one of the things on your tray was a little card with a Bible verse on Alaska Airlines. And then the atheist said, we can't, no, that's wrong. There are people who are not Jewish or Christian. They don't want to have that. And then they took it away.
Here's the thing, though, and I think this is why.
By the way, I just, forgive me.
Go ahead.
If I flew Air India, yeah, and it had a Bhagavad Gita little card, I'd be thrilled.
I'd be fascinated. It would be so interesting.
The narcissism. I don't believe in the Bible, so don't you dare put a Bible verse with my lunch.
Boy, have I been thinking about this point you brought up lately, that, you know, no one would think twice if you went on an India airline and they had, you know, their or a Muslim airline or, you know, and they had their own text. But then we hold ourselves to far different standards than we hold others to. I'll give you another example. Patriotism. It's seen as this terrible thing in America now to be patriotic, to love your country. If you love your country, then it's assumed that you endorse all the bad things in the past that your country did. If you love America, then it means that you loved slavery. It's BS. But then you look, would anybody dispute if someone from Iran said, I love my country? Would we look at that person and go, oh, you're saying you love your country? Well, does that mean that you love, you know, Sharia law? Does that mean that you love the morality police who killed Mahsa Amini in 2022 for having some strands of hair poke through her hijab? Oh, you love Iran? You like the subjugation of women, you know, enshrined in law? No one would think that. They would go, of course that person loves their country. So why is there this double standard? Why we who are in a comparatively free and tolerant country have to apologize for loving our country, but those in sick authoritarian countries don't have to apologize?
Maybe 25 years ago, I did a show, and the topic was some college removed the American flag. And their reason was, we have foreign students, so it's not inclusive.
I know. Well, that's why they don't teach Western Civ, because it's intellectually imperialist. If we went to study abroad at a French school or a Chinese school, and there was a mandatory Confucius education or, you know, Napoleonic War, would we think twice? No, because we know we're going into their territory.
Even in the West, would one of these U.S. leftists who opposes the U.S. flag at a college, if they went to a Norwegian university and they had a flag of Norway, would they object?
Of course not.
Even a Western country. It's hatred for Americana. That's what it is. This is about as fast as Dennis and Julie.
Are we done?
Yeah.
Well, okay, well, I wanted to bring something up.
So
from
bring
your
it
book
up. Bring it up next time.
We're really done.
Yeah, I know, but that's a good sign. She rarely says, "Are we?"
I lost track of time. I've been
Did people hear what he said?
No, no.
He lost track of time. He's been Googling Prager a-hole.
There is
How
so
many
much.
Did you come up with?
I have a new hobby. I know what I'm doing.
Oh, there is so
that's
much.
That's what he's going to be doing.
I actually enjoy now reading stuff because I know you so well that I know it's how absurd it is.
Are you being attacked on
yeah,
me?
Yeah, it's kind of funny.
Well, it's depressing. And I'm totally not speaking personally. It's depressing. Do you know that there is, I shouldn't even say this because it gives them publicity, but it's irrelevant. There's a whole website that is Prager, instead of PragerU, PragerUrine. Now, do you understand?
Sean is laughing.
To say immaturity, it gives immaturity a bad name.
Well, I'll leave you with this. When I was discovering my conservative instincts, that's the way I say it now. I don't say when I was becoming conservative. When I was discovering
yes,
my conservative
right.
instincts, and I was so taken with PragerU, I decided to watch some videos destroying PragerU videos.
Okay.
Because I thought, okay, well, I'm willing
right,
to be
course.
Convinced that these
yes.
people are scumbags.
Right.
And that is what made me even more convinced that you guys were the real deal. Watching the videos trying to excoriate
right.
you, and they were intellectually shallow
pathetic.
and
that's right.
immature and pathetic.
That's
so
right.
if it makes you feel any better.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah.
When I see that, I think, wow. I'll tell you that it's funny. Next time, maybe, because I have a whole reaction. I don't think I've ever told you. When people write me, just curse me out in an email.
Yeah.
I have a standard response.
What would your father say?
Yeah. No, no. Are you a father?
Oh, yeah, that's what it is.
So we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
This was really special.
I agree. You can reach me at julie@julie-hartman.com. And thank you all so much for your emails. It's painful, painful that I can't respond to all of you. But I read
but she,
all of them.
She sends them to me.
And I send them to Dennis. And they are just amazing. So keep them coming. And you can also follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Julie R. Hartman. You can follow Dennis on Twitter, right, Dennis? At
That's
Dennis
right.
Prager.
Yes.
And on Instagram.
Mostly at DennisPrager.com.
On Instagram at the Dennis Prager.
You really? That's
because
really nice to hear.
Every time. Every time.
I'm consistent.
And I'm consistent with this. Shalom. See you soon.
Bye.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.